Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of June. I will only mention her name once, and to tell you the truth, I know very little about her. But her name was associated with white privilege in discussions that were going on last week, Paris Hilton's, and we thought we would take a look at white privilege this hour of our program, and I think we have the perfect guest. Professor Peggy McIntosh is with us. Senior Research Scientist and Associate Director of the Wellesley Centers for Women. She is also the founder of the SEED Project, which helps teachers create their own year-long school-based seminars on making school climates, K-12 curricula, and teaching methods far more gender-fair and multiculturally equitable. She directs the Gender, Race, and Inclusive Education Project, which provides workshops on privileged systems, feelings of fraudulence, and diversifying workplaces, curricula, and teaching methods. She has taught English, American Studies, and Women's Studies at Harvard University, Trinity College, Durham University in England, and Wellesley College. And she is the co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Women's Institute and has been consulting editor to SAGE, a scholarly journal on black women. She has done a great deal of work here on white privilege, and she talks about the fact that as a white person, she had realized that she had been taught about racism as something that put others at a disadvantage, but had been taught not to see one of its corollary aspects, white privilege, which put her at an advantage. And so she spent a great deal of time on this issue and came up with this whole long list of the daily effects of white privilege. And we're going to talk about that this hour of the program. And welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Professor Peggy McIntosh, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Appreciate your invitation very much.
Yeah, we're happy to have you here. So what got you thinking about this to the depth at which you have thought about this? I mean, you've written some very interesting things about white privilege. What got you thinking about it?
What got me thinking was that I was in seminars with very nice and quite brave white men who were agreeing to study new scholarship on women with us, group of women professors. But year after year, when the question came, how can we get some of this new scholarship on women into the first-year students' courses, the freshman courses, the men said, we're sorry, the syllabus is full. It's fascinating new work, but we can't get in extras when we're trying to lay the foundations for knowledge. And they were calling us, and of course then their mothers and sisters and spouses or partners, extra. And yet they were very, very nice men.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said to you, they were brave for joining conversations on new scholarship on women 20 years ago. And I went back and forth in my mind as they said things like, well, when you're trying to help the students get the foundations for knowledge, you can't put in soft stuff. I was going back and forth in my head, not liking being called soft.
Right, right.
On the other hand, I admired all of these men, and I appreciated they would travel to Wellesley College for 5 hours a month to talk about all this. So I went back and forth in my mind, are they nice men, or are they, and I didn't want to use this word, but I began to feel I needed it, are they oppressive in their attitudes? And I thought I had to choose. Either they're nice or they're oppressive, until suddenly it chimed in my mind that back in 1980, I had read two essays by black women in the Boston area, and both had said, almost as a matter of fact, to their sister readers, if you get into women's studies, do remember that white women are oppressive to work with. That wasn't their main point. It was just a reminder. If you do try to enter women's studies, remember white women are oppressive to work with. And I remembered reading that, those two statements. And I was astonished by them. And this is where I was in 1980. You'll hear I was very racist myself. My first thought was, I don't see how they can say that about us. I think we're nice. I especially think we're nice if we work with them. And then I realized how oppressive that must make
exactly.
me.
Yeah.
And I had hoped that my niceness would somehow override my sense that that I should be thanked for working with anybody I had been taught to look down on.
Mm-hmm.
So then I thought, maybe niceness has nothing to do with it. These are nice men in the seminars I facilitate. These are very nice men, and they are brave men to do this work. And at the same time, and it's not their fault, they were born into a curriculum that said they are the real people in the world of knowledge. They have knowledge, they make more knowledge, they profess it, they publish it. They're in charge of all the major universities, which was true back in 1980. And I realized that it's not about niceness. It's that they were taught men are knowers and knowledge is male, and they're working on that. And though I don't have any entitlement into the system on grounds of sex, I do have it on grounds of race, that I was taught, and it wasn't my fault. Whites have knowledge. Whites make more knowledge. Most of the books are about whites. And whites publish knowledge and profess knowledge and run the organizations. And I realized I had white privilege, and it had nothing to do with whether or not I was a nice person. The knowledge system let me in, not because I was male, but because I was white.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you, as you say, whites are carefully taught not to recognize white privilege as males are taught not to recognize male privilege. It comes as an enlightenment all of a sudden. The light goes off.
Oh, it was pretty horrible, but it was indeed an enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
It was, maybe I didn't earn tenure as I would have, in the same sense I would have had to if I were a woman of color.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it puts me ahead that my children can count on finding people of their race in every single course they take in school
sure.
and college.
Sure.
Maybe this puts us ahead in the way of having confidence and entree and, you know, being given the benefit of the doubt because we're seen in the group that is knowing. And it's the group actually that I learned about in college when I took an English course that included the English literary critic and commentator Matthew Arnold, and he wrote about the best that has been thought and said in the world. And I felt he knew what that was, and now I would learn it from him. And there was no question about, well, who's defining best or who benefits from his definitions of what's best.
Mm-hmm. Tell me the process you went through when you decided to do work on yourself by identifying, as you say, some of the daily effects of white privilege in your life.
Well, this is quite an amazing process to me to this day, because once I saw that as a white person, I had been taught that I was a knower, even if I wasn't a man, still I was in the knowledge system. Then I looked at the place where I work, Wellesley's. At the time, it was called the Wellesley College Center for Research on Women. And I thought, I have the fact that I come from the racial group that is seen as knowledgeable on my side here. And since we work by getting grants and gifts and contracts, but mostly grants, I have an in with the grant-giving agencies because they, at the unconscious level, trust me as a white. And that would, and I don't have to prove that I'm better than other whites in order to get a grant. And then I realized that put the money system as well as the knowledge system on my side. And I thought that was very deep. I had entered the Centers for Women in 1979, assuming that we all in this building had equal chances at grants. And now I began to see, as I said, these rather horrible things that meant that it wasn't equitable here, but it's not that we were to blame. It's that we were in a bigger system that gave me more credibility than my colleagues who were African-American. So then, and I had heard a number of their stories about what it was like for them to live or work in the Boston suburbs, and I asked myself, what have I learned in those stories that is about things that wouldn't happen to me and did happen to them with regard to institutions and the police force and so on? And In other words, I asked myself, what do I have aside from the money system and the knowledge system helping me in this building that my African-American colleagues here don't have? And I compared myself just with them. And my conscious mind said, nothing. There's nothing more to talk about. And I asked again more specifically, because I thought I had seen something very big. So I said, well, really, on a daily basis, by contrast with my African-American friends in this building, what do I get because of white skin that they don't, that they can't count on?
And you came up with reason after reason after reason. You came up with all kinds of things.
But I came up with 46, but I have to tell you, that wasn't the next step, Kathleen. When I asked the second time, my conscious mind, you know, the one with all the graduate degrees and all, still said nothing. And so I had to pray on it. And I asked, or by that time, I wasn't even asking. I was really quite angry. I told my unconscious mind, or my subconscious, I think a psychiatrist would say. I asked my subconscious mind to tell me, I said, if I have anything working for me, because I'm white, by contrast with my African-American friends in this, in the Wellesley building, show me. Of course, by then I knew I had the money system and the knowledge system. And over the next 3 months, 46 examples, which is what you're referring to, a list of 46 examples swam up. But I didn't want to know them because they disturbed my sense of being a person, a hardworking a person who had earned everything she'd gotten. And they also disturbed my sense of the United States being a working democracy because I began to think of things, of course, this was decades before the Florida non-elections, but I began to see that I had things like access to voting machines, being able to count on having my vote count in a way that people from some other communities might not have. Now, that didn't make it into the list because I didn't know it on my pulses for sure, by contrast with my African-American colleagues. But that's the sort of thing that began to weaken my grip on the thought that the United States was really a working democracy. And some of your listeners will say, well, I was very naive to come to that understanding so late. But, of course, others of your listeners will say, I never should have come to that understanding at all because we're a better working democracy than most places in the world. So this is an autobiographical list, and I'm just telling you where I personally was in that in the journey you wanted to know about of coming up with a list of ways in which I had unearned advantage, by contrast with just one tiny sample of African-American colleagues.
Yeah. Do you have a list in front of you?
Yep.
Okay. Because I'd like for you to tell us what they are, because I think it's important to hear them. But we'll pause for a moment first, okay?
Okay.
And then hear them. We're talking this hour of the program about white privilege and welcoming your phone calls for our guest, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Professor Peggy McIntosh is our guest, senior research scientist and associate director of the Wellesley Centers for Women, also the founders of the founder of the SEED Project, helping teachers create their own year-long school-based seminars on making school climates, K through 12 curricula, and teaching methods more gender fair and multiculturally equitable. They do a great deal of work in after-school bullying, child and adolescent development, child care and early child education, in education, families in society, gender violence, harassment and abuse, human rights, leadership, relational cultural theory, workplace diversity, and leadership. And I would think that she's going to generate a few calls here. Our number is 800-486-8655. Some time ago, she says, she was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems of conferring dominance on her group, her white group. And so she thought about this long and hard, and over the period of some time, some years ago, came up with a number of examples, the daily effects of white privilege. There are 46 of them. She will tell us what they are in just a moment, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be talking about Clarence Thomas with the authors of this really, really interesting book on a very complicated man. Supreme Discomfort is the name of the book, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. The authors are from the Washington Post. They are African-American, and they actually say they hounded Clarence Thomas to get him to participate in this book, but he just didn't want to. But it's very, very thorough. They have talked to classmates of him, people who he grew up with, his mother, and we'll be looking at Clarence Thomas and why he is who he is, and who he is, the second hour of our program tomorrow. 800-486-8655. Professor Peggy McIntosh is our guest, senior research scientist and associate director. I asked her, she has gone through the 46 reasons, and there are probably more than that now, of how she sees white privilege on a daily basis, and she has it in front of her, and I want to hear it. I think you probably do, too. Go right ahead, Professor McIntosh.
Right. Well, for anybody who just joined the program, I want to stress this is an autobiographical list, and I compared myself only with African-American coworkers and friends and acquaintances whom I saw a lot of. And most of them cannot count on these conditions. I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time. The day I move into new housing that I've chosen, I can be pretty sure my neighbors will welcome me with a neutral attitude or a pleasant one.
Hmm.
I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured I will not be followed or harassed. My African-American friends were followed and harassed by store detectives on grounds they might be shoplifting or, back then, 20 years ago when I wrote this, picking up men. When I'm told about our national heritage or about civilization, I'm shown that people of my color gave it its strong points. I can be sure that our children will be given curricular materials that testify to the existence of their race, and that is in every course, at every grade level, right up through graduate school. If I want to, I can be pretty sure of finding a publisher for this piece on white privilege. When white privilege is to be believed when you say white privilege exists, or to be better believed than a person of color will be. I'm happy to tell you, Kathleen, the next one is obsolete. I can go into a music shop and count on finding the music of my race represented. If you can believe it, in my town there used to be two white music shops, and there I could count on being represented and people of color couldn't. Now I don't know of a music shop that could really survive if it were so
true.
White.
Right, right.
The other two are still pretty true. I can go in as white privileges. I can go into a supermarket and find the staple foods which fit with my cultural traditions, or into a hairdresser's shop and find somebody who can deal with my hair without complaining that I've got a problem hair. The next is financial. Whether I use checks, credit cards, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of financial reliability, and I'm never asked for two IDs. I can arrange to protect our children most of the time from people who might not like them. And this next is about being treated like an individual rather than a carrier of a whole racial group reputation. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals of my race, the poverty of my race, or the illiteracy of my race. There's such daily freedom in being not having to carry the reputation of all whites as I do this or that. I can speak in public to a powerful male group without putting my whole race on trial. And I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. Though I'm happy to say once at a conference, a group of black women approached and they said, "Well, Peggy, you know, you really are a credit to your race." And I said, "Well, from you, I will take this as a compliment." But And this is a corollary of that. I'm never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group.
Hmm.
If I'm the only person of my race in a group, they don't look to me for the white opinion.
Right.
You know,
right.
They know it's a white opinion.
Right.
I'm sorry to say this one is clumsily worded, but here it is. I can remain oblivious of the language and the customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling in my culture any penalty for being so oblivious.
Hmm.
I just don't know how to say it more simply.
Mm-hmm.
The next one has become clouded since I wrote the paper. It's not quite so true, but here it is. I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behavior without being seen as a cultural outsider. I would say that that's not quite so true. I am so not. Depends on who's commentating,
mm-hmm.
but people who share the kind of view I have are sometimes now seen as cultural outsiders to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, the next, I can be pretty sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will be actually facing a person of my race.
Gotcha.
And the higher I go in the hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
the more likely that it is to be true.
Mm-hmm.
If a traffic officer pulls me over, or if the IRS audits my tax return, I can be sure I haven't been singled out because of my race.
Hmm.
And I can easily buy posters, postcards, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines that feature people of my racial ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
And I can go home from most meetings of organizations that I choose to belong to feeling somewhat tied in rather than isolated, out of place, outnumbered, unheard, held at a distance, or feared. And I can take a job with an affirmative action employer. Of course, this was written in 79. So, still, I can take a job with an affirmative action. I'm sorry, I wrote it in 86. I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having coworkers on the job suspect that I got it because
right.
of my race, that
right.
I keep it because of my race, and that my next promotion will be because of my race.
Mm-hmm.
I can choose public accommodation without fearing that people of my race cannot get in or will be mistreated in the places I have chosen to stay. And if I need legal or medical help, I can be sure that my race won't work against my getting such help. I'll finish with these two. I'm only about halfway through the list, but I don't want to overload you and your listeners. The next is, if my day or week or year is going badly, I need not ask of each negative episode or situation whether it has racial tones, overtones, and if so, what the racial angle is
mm-hmm.
on what's going badly for me.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, on this reduced list, I can choose blemish cover or bandages in so-called flesh color
mm-hmm.
and have them more or less match my skin.
Mm-hmm. What's amazing as you go through those is that some of them have changed, but the others still hold so true 20 years later.
Yes, and it's been, I'm happy to say that the last one has changed. Johnson & Johnson no longer labels the standard Band-Aid flesh colored, except in Sweden, where unfortunately it is called flesh still, though there are many Bangladeshi and other people in Stockholm. But here in the United States, I'm happy to say Johnson & Johnson is putting out a variety of Band-Aid tones. And one could say, oh, that's trivial. That doesn't matter. No, actually, I believe it matters a lot.
Yeah.
And the Crayola crayon people did a wonderful thing when they took the so-called flesh-colored crayon and renamed it, and peach, and then under pressure from lobbyists, including my sister at UNICEF and me here at Wellesley, and other teachers and parents, Crayola now has a 16-color multicultural skin tone box.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and this
great,
makes so
great.
Much difference
sure
to
it is.
Children
sure it is.
Trying to find something in kindergarten and first grade and
yeah.
right up through that matches, more or less matches their skin.
Yeah.
It's a deep matter of identity.
We're speaking with Professor Peggy McIntosh, Senior Research Scientist and Associate Director of the Wellesley Centers for Women and author of White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. Welcoming phone calls for her. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join this conversation on white privilege. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Dakey from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Dakey.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. And Peggy, I just love your work. I ran across an internet reference on you and have really enjoyed all the freedom you give me in writing what you do.
Oh, thank you.
It was a real... I have two things I'd like to say. One is I very much appreciate all the reflection of our economic inequality in what you're saying about white privilege.
Yeah.
But I feel that our democracy is failing because we haven't... I mean, we're pre-civil rights for sure when it comes to economic equality. But the thing I wanted to ask you about is that I've started working towards establishing a culture of peace at a global level. And I find that the organizations that I work with, as well as, and I don't mean this as a blanket, I'm meaning this as an attitude that's similar to an awakening as per what you went through, mm-hmm. is that a lot of people working for this more kind of idealistic, though very practical, consideration are white. And I feel as if the violence of economic inequality doesn't even allow for a diversity the likes of which I'd prefer to work with in seeking this, you know, culture of peace.
And how do you account for the fact that so many of the people working in these organizations are white?
Well, I do it. I think of it as. I'm not sure that individuals of color have the privilege of the time to be as philosophical as this cause might inspire.
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of it, and that's part of what you're talking about in economic realities. But I also think they have good reason to mistrust whites. Will our models of peace be racially sensitive and inclusive? And if not, why should they join us?
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so how is it that a movement such as I'm interested in can reach out? Is there something that your understanding of white privilege in that economic realm, a lot of which, you know, is reflected economically, can reach out? Because we won't have peace until we have diversity and economic equality.
My image for it is actually we can't reach out. We need to step back from the center and become part of a circle of people from many different economic backgrounds and statuses. And it's hard to be decentered if you didn't know you were central to begin with. So it's very dizzying and sort of nauseating to step back and join it. Be told, get out of the circle. Don't reach out. Join our circle, please. And it's a bigger circle than you. And you can play your part in it because we fight. People can have a lot of influence in the way we use our power. But it needs to be stepping out to the circle and joining it. In my main project with teachers, the staff is 9 people of color and 5 whites. And that's a matter of conscious recruiting and
interesting.
And then forming a psychological circle in which we all get equal time. And white, so though I founded Seed, my voice is just one of the 14. And when we go around the circle on policy, on making program and all, I get equal time with everyone else. So for me, the reaching out metaphor didn't work. It had to do with sharing ownership.
Yeah. You know, and as you said that, I'm trying to think of places in America where that happens, and I'm thinking what you got going is still quite a rarity.
It is. It is. There's been a Seed seminar, several, in fact, quite a few, at the Prairie School and in Racine. There have been quite a few at University of Wisconsin. There's been a lot of Seed activity in your state, but the form of the circle with everybody getting equal time is really unusual.
Yeah.
And I work with an anti-racist white group here in Boston, and boy, is it hard for us to share the time. It's just so hard to get over the habit of having a white habit of being in control.
Right, right.
But we're working on it. We've been together now for 3.5, going on 4 years. So I wish you well, and of course, what you say is true, that most of the efforts that have been started by white people toward peace and justice remain pretty white unless we do this major thing on ourselves. I love an anecdote I want to tell you about my time at University of Denver.
Okay.
When at a Christmas party, a religious studies professor said to the chair of my department, "Oh, by the way, is swearing allowed on your program, or will it be beeped?"
It depends on how bad it is, I guess. You know the words that I'd have a problem with. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it won't be bleeped. But a religious studies professor said to the head of my English department, "You know, you guys keep putting together reading lists about man as hero and the hero on a quest and men's quests." And he said, "And I just want to let you know, I don't see my life as a quest." So the head of the English department said to him, "Well, who the hell are you then, anyway?" And my colleague in religious studies, he thought for a minute, half a minute, it's like 20 seconds. You radio people know what 20 seconds, that's a long time.
Yes, it is.
Maybe just 10 seconds.
Yeah.
He just thought for a little bit, and then he said, "I am a body in the body of the world." Now, that has become a mantra for me within the Seed Project. Even though I started it and have major fundraising responsibilities for it, and major administrative responsibilities, which I take on it, nevertheless, within the frame of what we're trying to do, I am a body in the body of the world. And I find organizational life can go joyously when that is happening.
Yes, yes.
And there's always a demand for people to come into the project, and lots of people want to be on the staff. So I think we have created the circle that I was taught never to create. I was taught at the unconscious level, white people need to be in charge and need to make the statements. Now what I see is the niche in the circle that I occupy has a lot to do with getting the money. But the wisdom and the good energy of the project does not emanate from me. I'm just a body in the body of the world of getting the work done.
Yeah, I like that. Let's go to Julie next from Appleton. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Hey, I am so excited to hear this show. I am an adoptive mom. I'm Caucasian, and my children are African American. And when we were looking into adopting and considering, you know, what we would accept, we said we had no problem with accepting any race, and the social worker asked us, "Are you really prepared, and do you know what it means to raise a child of African descent?" And she made a study, and we looked into it and realized it wasn't about what we would accept. It was about what we could do for them, because we really had no idea of the challenges they faced. So I have found it with the help of some beautiful people in our community here in Appleton, a Black Heritage camp. And in the planning sessions, I am finding so many things that I've never heard about. And just, we had one last week, Tuesday, and I learned about how maps were made. And we're trying to offer resources to the parents that come to our camp. And I said, "Well, what's the difference between a map that you guys would, you know, say, or we could offer that would be different from a regular map?" And they said, "What people don't realize is that maps, when they were created, the areas where there were Black people on them were minimized.
Yeah.
They were made smaller than they actually are."
Yeah.
And that's just a way of minimizing people.
Yeah.
And I think people don't realize, you know, all the little subtle ways that people are discriminated against.
Well, if I were to translate what you've just said into white privilege terms, is I can count on places where the population of my ethnic group is dense disproportionately large on the maps I and my children study. That's the way I would translate it. The disproportionality of, in other words, overrepresentation, that's a white privilege. And once again, it's not about blame or shame or guilt for us. You're discovering things that you had no part in making.
Right.
But you are seeing a system on map making.
Right.
That's a racial system. I am so glad that your social worker asks you seriously, are you prepared, do you know what it means to raise a child of African-American descent? Because many white people have felt that they don't have any special privileges, they're just normal, and that their regular safety and security in life will be transferred to their children, whom they have construed as disadvantaged, or the old word used to be underprivileged. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't mean that those doing the adoption don't have a good heart and aren't intelligent. It's that none of us was taught to know the difference between what a white family can expect and what it will be projected onto children of color. And you can see it in the supermarket. I often say that the best readers of my work on white privilege are those who are on the cusp of African-American and white experience, or in some other way have been across culturally, cross-racially, cross-ethnic, ethnically connected, so that they see both sides, what it's like to have white skin privilege and what it is like not to have it. So you, bless your heart, have put yourself in a position where you see both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad, I'm really impressed that you have chosen to do your homework and learn about these systemic things like map making that over-advantaged whites and while disadvantaging, in this case, African Americans.
Yeah.
And I have a different list of unearned advantages relative to people of each ethnic group that I work with, indigenous and Latino, Hispanic, Chicano, and Asian American. It's each list is different. White privilege is kind of like a Weeble doll. Some of your older listeners in Wisconsin will remember Weeble dolls, as I do. Whatever direction you push them down, they flip up again. And so it's a different list of over-advantage in each case.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Joe next from Cottage Grove. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start off by saying I'm a white male, and my question is, I know just from my experience with other white males that a lot of them will not admit or even even see that this is even an issue. How would you approach, how do you approach white males in addressing this issue and enlightening them into this even being an issue? And also my other question is, how can white males like myself and other white males, what can they do to help further this, further educate other people, whites and other people just in our community? And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Thanks so much for the call.
I'm glad you have the question, and I'm sorry you've had the experience of finding it hard, but it is hard, so you've laid it out there. What I find is that unless white men know they're hurting, they can't get very interested in the idea that they have male privilege and that it has hurt them. So if you go back to male conditioning, and you get into men's groups or you get into church groups where men are speaking with each other about their earliest memories of being taught to be a boy, you will see a lot of pain come up. Being born male includes hearing the lie, boys don't cry. It involves a lot of training and toughening up and not caring and pretending you don't care and denying your feelings. And men who can level with the fact that this cost them sees that mixed in with the male entitlement economically and educationally to thinking that they were real folks, picked up a lot of pressure to pretend and to take control even if they didn't feel in control. Once men know that they have been in a system of gender that was hard on everyone, the men and the women, then they can begin to move sideways into a system of race in which whites were taught, you implicitly, you are superior. You come from the best that has been thought and said and done in the world, and you deserve control, and that life will be all right for you because you're so deserving. And then they can talk about the pain they feel when, in fact, they're blamed. They're seen as where they're called all kinds of names, and they're seen as the world's problem. And men who begin to feel that, or see that reaction against white maleness, can go in two directions. And one is to just hunker down and get more and more entrenched in what they were taught. You were tough, you should be in control, you're the best. Or they can go in the direction of, oh, these systems didn't work well for me gender-wise. And for me, race-wise, they're not working well either. I'm tired of being blamed for being a racist. Okay, and then some motion can occur. So I wish you well in being in the kind of conversations that allow men to say they've been hurt by being given so much responsibility to try to keep control and be on top and be racially and ethnically predominant and be gender-wise dominant. Yeah. It's a hard row to hoe. And the time will come when we heterosexual people see we have been also oppressed by heterosexism. And it hasn't been good for us who identify as heterosexual to be taught to disrespect or work against any of the kinds of love in the world. Love is a scarce commodity. And I've written a long short list of heterosexual privileges which work the same way in a big system in which those who are told you're in control and you're best and you're doing life right actually learn better that we are bodies in the body of the world, and the world is diverse, and the world among people can be very humane if we can lessen these tremendous peaks and pinnacles of superiority and inferiority.
Yeah. Could you take on, just because it's been very much on our minds for some time now, could you take on the issue of white privilege as it comes to immigration in this country, in terms of the huge, huge rallies we saw for legislation on the part of immigrants, the language that is used, these illegal aliens, the fact that that we're seeing a brown face involved here and that the work that these people are doing is work that's real hard, that's real physical, that nobody does in this country, this hatred that you hear in terms of they're here illegally, send those people back, blank, blank. You know, there's yeah. something nasty and ugly about all of this, and put the face of white privilege on it, if you would, please.
Oh dear, I was hoping you would guide me to the world situation, which is easier for me to talk about than immigration, because you're so very much more close to it. But let me give you my East Coast read on
sure.
autobiographically how my Irish ancestors came here as illegal immigrants and did a whole lot for the making of the United States. And Italian people, whom the Irish were taught to fight with by the WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, Italians came to the Boston area, did a whole lot for Boston, still do.
Yeah.
Both of those groups were considered non-American. They were not considered white. You can read David Roediger and others on the subject of how Italians, Irish, and also Jewish people were not considered white at the time when they came from, well, Jews especially, into the Lower East Side of New York City, and then came up the coast. All of these people have built what I know of as East Coast culture, or mm-hmm. the United States mm-hmm. culture. And none of them, and they worked hard, and they did daily labor, and they created civilization here in the United States. I imagine, though I don't live in L.A. and I don't see the border and I don't see the crossing and I don't see the danger, but I imagine that the whole country is indebted to people who are now being hated as illegal aliens. I imagine that the lettuce that I eat here in Massachusetts was harvested, and I fear maybe also pesticided by those illegal aliens, that my standard of living, getting good lettuce or good strawberries, mm-hmm. has been, on the face of it, raised by the hard work of these groups you're talking about who are willing to do work mm-hmm. that most whites won't do. But when it comes to what law to craft, I feel completely at a loss. I can't understand the Kennedy legislation in any detail. And I know that I don't like the nastiness of people who just got in 60 years ago themselves
right.
and now want to
right.
shut the door.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't like the attitudes, the sort of Aryan Nation attitudes of the people who want to shoot those who are crossing the border.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that's white privilege, male privilege. It has a more than white male, white male privilege. It's in this, it's backed up by threat of violence.
Yeah. Well, I think you gave a superb answer to that. I feel like I can ask you just about anything, Peggy. Thank you. Thanks for your answer. Let's go to Dan from Eau Claire next. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, Kathleen, I think this is a fair question. What's the racial makeup of the on-air broadcasters for Wisconsin Public Radio?
We don't have enough minorities. I've said that for years.
So seeing as how you care so deeply about this, don't you think there's some minorities that would gladly take your place? And since you do care so deeply, wouldn't you be willing to resign to let one take your place?
I'll be you don't like me, do you, Dan?
Well, to do your part in the fight.
Well, you know.
Since you care so deeply about this, you want other people to change. Now, I would say you should step up to the plate and do your part.
Well, you know, I don't think I do a bad job. I care about what I do and have done it. Wait, Dan, I'm not done yet. And I've done it for a long period of time. And I will be retiring at some point, and I would hope that I would be replaced by someone of color, because I do think we need this here on public radio, and I've urged us to look at other voices for a long period of time. But I don't think, you know, and I think that we highlight a lot of these issues, and it's because, you know, you can be sensitive to a lot of issues if you're white as well. Just because you can be aware of your white privilege, you can be, but it doesn't mean that you need to relinquish what it is that you're doing. I think that we try to, in our way, make the world a better place. Professor McIntosh?
That makes a lot of sense to me. I work with a white anti-racist group, and we're not looking for people of color to replace us. We're trying to work on ourselves and do what we can, being white, to spread. In this case, it's spread awareness of the way the racial ethnic system works in the city of Boston,
mm-hmm.
and make the city of Boston a place where everybody knows they belong. Now, we're not about to trade in our identity as whites working against racism for people of color working against racism. We're doing parallel work.
Mm-hmm.
And white privilege does give any broadcaster who's white a shot right now at programming and designing program. And frankly, I think white understanding white privilege and programming that does a lot more good than somebody who doesn't understand white privilege and is programming only on the downside, always disadvantage, issues connected with being oppressed. This is quite an unusual program in dealing squarely with the issues of over-entitlement,
right.
The upside of discrimination. And it's not every white that could do that. I see this conversations program as a rare asset to the idea life, and the ideal life of Wisconsin,
yeah.
Which is a state I admire a lot to begin
yeah.
with.
And yet we are so far, here at Public Radio, we are so far from all sitting around that table that you so beautifully described earlier, Peggy. I mean, that's a
yeah.
goal, I think, for America. That is what America, that's the dream of America in terms of what my dream is for America.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, even at enlightened public radio, we have a problem with that as well. You know,
yeah.
most broadcast media, look who the heck does all the analysis of debates that
yeah.
we're seeing. And the big thing about the Democrats is that they're more than just white males this go around, too. We're making a big thing of that. We have a long way to go, a long way to go, I think.
Of course. Well, I give it 200 years, but
wow.
we're not going to make it to 200 years if we don't keep working along these ways of widening out our sense of who exists, what matters,
mm-hmm.
and how to make and mend the whole fabric,
mm-hmm.
locally and globally.
Yeah. So let's go next to Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. I know your time is running short, so I'll try and be brief. I know with some of the with the previous caller, but with the caller before that, they were maybe with the caller before the previous caller. He was talking about, well, me being a white male, you know, I've tried to certainly approach this. It's something I've grappled with. I know when I have talked with other white males, and they're not even some of them of the upper classes, they feel because of the whole PC culture, and I'm certainly not defending their views, they feel, hey, we're the ones that are now being discriminated against. It seems we're the ones that have to mind their P's and Q's. I know for me, I try to make sense out of these issues. A couple years ago, I read a alternate history fictional series that dealt with where whites were the slaves and African culture had been dominant. And even though it was just a fictional story, I think what the author tried to do, and he was a black man, mm-hmm. tried to get people thinking about race and maybe seeing how things might be if the shoe was on the other foot.
We have about 20 seconds. Boy, we're almost out of time. 20 seconds, Peggy.
Right. Well, I go back historically when I hear those. First of all, I empathize with white men who are feeling they're being decentered. It is sickening to be decentered if you didn't know you were central to begin with. So they're good guys. They're not outright racist, probably, and they resent any of this talk. I go way back to the beginning of the country when white people, including my female ancestors, settled for taking all the land from all the Indian people. Mm. And whenever whites say, well, now we're being decentered, you know, and this isn't fair. No, well, it wasn't fair the way we got hold of the continental U.S.
On that note, we have to end. Thank you so much for being with us. What a fascinating hour this one was. Thanks.
Thanks for the ideas.
Professor Peggy McIntosh, Senior Research Scientist, Associate Director of the Wellesley Centers for Women, author of White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and we'd like to thank Rita Thomas and Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Sharome Owens for doing on-air production, and thanks for your calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.